To do the show. It is cracking lightning, there's thunder, there's rain a blowing. It's pretty awesome. And just a little reminder for you, you are in your car because you feel safe in your little car. But when we get these storms like that, all of the old oil and the exhaust and everything else has been sitting on the road. That rain comes, lifts it up a little bit, and creates a little layer of slick stuff on there. It's like black ice, boys and girls. Most of the time, you're going to be fine. But if you're one of those people that's got to hit the gas, run to the next red light, slam on the brakes so you can save a quarter second over that, that might not be a good idea today or any day when we get those rains. Florida has a very unique thing, its own version of black ice, where it's the oils that have dried onto the road and kind of stuck into the asphalt and the asphalt layer. And when that water hits it, it builds it up and can create a little tiny slick layer on there where your tires just won't grab. So ease off on the throttle. Just when you see the light turn red, instead of keeping on the gas to the last minute, it's really difficult. But you might want to be able to just think about it. If you took your foot off of the gas when you saw the light is red, just think, you could coast to a stop, save yourself some gas, save repairs on your brakes, and maybe save a family member. So, anyway, there's your public service announcement for the day.
Well, and I have to say that I've been guilty of that. I did that in a Chevy Town & Country van not too long ago while it was raining, and my daughter said, I didn't know you could make a van peel out.
It's amazing. I love when it rains because I get out there and do donuts, you know? Yeah. You've got that first 15 minutes, maybe 10 minutes of that rain where it's slick.
After we just told people to be careful.
Well, I'm doing it in an open area. I'm not around anybody.
Oh, okay.
I could slam the gas of that Toyota, watch her spin a 360. It's fun as heck. But, you know, I'm trying to use a little common sense. Doesn't mean I want to... you know, be quiet all the time. But when I'm driving around other people, I like being more cautious. We've been talking about, we've got some other fishing shows on the great WKDW here. And we've got the Fishy Radio, which is four women who are doing a women's version of a fishing show, I guess would be.
Yeah, yeah.
And
from a women's perspective.
And I know it's a good show because I have a lot of the guys who listen to the show. It's on Fridays at
2 o'clock.
2 o'clock here at the big KDW. And when the guys listen to it, they go, I don't like it. I'm like, perfect. This is a show produced by women. I trained them, got them going, but tried not to influence them. And then we've got Sunday mornings, right now at like 10 or 11 o'clock?
Yeah, I don't have the schedule in front of me. We'll be launching all of these things within the next 2 weeks. So all the shows that Frank's about to tell you about will be live shortly.
And that's God and Fishing. Well, Pastor Donnie is the God part. I'm the fishing part. And he is one funny son of a gun. And so if you want a little religion and a little... laughs and, you know, some fishing information, that's a real good one. And that's going to be on Sunday mornings here on the big KDW. And then we've also got Cook and Fish. And Cook and Fish is exactly what it's about. Landing the fish, what do you do on the boat to get you so that you're going to have a good meal later? From when you take it off the hook, what do you do? Do you put it in ice? Do you gut it? Do you bleed it? What you do at that point, all the way up to the ingredients and how you cook it, and that's cooking fish. And that's going to be Captain Barry and Pastor Donnie doing that one, because Pastor Donnie's an awesome cook, man. I mean, this guy really cooks. And then we've got Barry's Tarpon World, which is a big fish show. And that's going to be not only about catching big fish like cobia, sharks, tarpon, but how do you catch the bigger trout? How do you catch that biggest trout, really that, you know, large size fish, the big bluegill, the bigger bass? How do you get that 10-pound bass? How do you get that over 40-inch snook? Not just, you know, the big fish like the tuna and the all that, but how do you catch the bigger one of the species you're catching? All about you catching your personal best record, or maybe even a world record, big fish of whatever species. I think that's about it, isn't it? I think that's about it.
Well, you got bull.
Oh yeah, we've got a freshwater show coming up, but that one's not in the bag yet. I haven't run him through his audition, so all the other ones are trained, worked out, really starting to sound good. They're all, you know, getting into their place, because what I did was not take radio personalities. I took good people, and I'm teaching them to do the radio part of it, but without trying to influence my style and my opinions in their show. Just trying to let them, because the personalities of the people are, it's amazing. So,
and you also have Southern Fried Living getting ready to.
Oh, yeah. I like that. It's all about old Florida lifestyle, you know. Josh's aunt and Josh sit and talk about what life has been like, because they've been here forever in the Port Charlotte Arcadia area. And it's a whole different viewpoint of Southern living. And that's a great show. And she is funny.
Yeah, and this isn't your slick Southern Living magazine.
No,
this is the real deal.
This is real deal. And I think she's awesome. I was listening to the show and I went, yeah, I want to produce this show. And all these shows are done, myself, RJ, and Robert. We're picking the host, picking the topics, finding the people who can do these. So you're going to have some amazing programming to listen to.
And a lot of different personalities on top of that.
Oh, yeah.
Which makes it really unique.
And I can tell you, what's really weird is I've been in radio since the 80s. And I've always usually worked with guys, because mostly I've been doing fishing stuff, right? And to have a show with four women on it, when they get talking, they're kind of naughty.
You think?
I mean, really, I mean, the guys here, it's a very thin line. They stay on that side of the line, and they don't cross it. You know, they know this is it. With the women, it's like, the line is a quarter mile wide, and they kind of thread in and out of it all the time, and occasionally just ignore it entirely.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. But let's get to number one fish in the harbor right now. What's the number one fish to catch?
Spanish mackerel would be probably the most abundant fish to catch.
Yeah. I might agree with you. I might not.
Is that typical for this time of year?
No.
I was going to say it's kind of late in the season for them to be here.
Very late. You know, that's what makes it so unusual, that there's actual, like, targetable numbers out there right now. I mean, you can fish from the upper end of the harbor, you know, marker 2, which is just
about 2 miles
south of the 41 bridge. I mean, all the way out to Boca Grande, even into the Gulf a little bit, and especially around the Boca Grande Pass areas where you're better concentrations of fish are at. The rest are just kind of peppered throughout the whole harbor.
But now, almost from the hill inside, across the intercoastal, Boca Grande Pass, and out through the first few markers in the shipping lane,
yeah,
is just massive schools of, I think massive schools is the wrong way to phrase it, just massive amounts of small schools of Spanish mackerel.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not talking a half a dozen different little schools of Spanish mackerel. We're talking 100, 200, 400 little schools of Spanish mackerel.
Yeah.
And they seem to go size generated. If you've got a bunch of 12-inchers, they're all kind of together. 18s are over here. 22s are over there.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And if you look in the water out there, you'll see that they're feeding on little tiny, tiny fry, anywhere from 3/4 of an inch to an inch and a half long at the most.
So the pompano jig, banana jig, crazy jig would be a good one for them right now with that little bait they're feeding on?
The banana jig or an 1/8 ounce spoon is what guys have been catching them on. Even the guy tried that double zero Clark spoon, so they wouldn't hit it. He had to drop down to his little trout, essentially, like what he would use.
So those little tiny Johnson spoons that we keep in stock for the guys, because occasionally you actually have to have them.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they're so small, they're like little freshwater.
Yeah, it's something you would associate
with
trout
fishing. Something you think of for freshwater trout.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's been the key. And then a couple guys, actually, the one guy, he actually caught several on just a plain old 1/16 ounce jig head. No soft plastic on it, nothing, just the jig head.
So, a little piece of color going through the water. I mean, we've caught tons of ladyfish and everything else on those.
Well, we did that one time out there when off the beach where they were biting our line-to-line knot off.
Right.
With that movement in the water. You know, so there's times where they're just that specifically focused on that
now,
small bait.
I did hear a cool trick, because if I'm casting for Spanish mackerel, I most often will use the very cheap little black pre-made leaders with the swivel and the snap on it. But a lot of guys want to use a monofilament leader, a 30, 40-pound mono leader. Mm-hmm. Now, when they tie the line-to-line knot, that's where you usually get hit. It's got a little bit of cavitation, and the knot is a bigger thing in the water. Because by the time you tie 30 or 40-pound test, you got a pretty good object there.
Yeah.
Even if you're tying it to braid, part of that's still pretty good size, like a little nymph or a bug or a crab in the water. Guy was taking a black magic marker and coloring that knot, just taking the black magic marker, and they didn't hit the knot.
Wow.
Not doing the line, not doing the leader, but
just the knot itself.
Yeah, where you tie your knot, you got a uni to uni knot between your braided line and your 40-pound or 30-pound test fluorocarbon leader. He's taking a black magic marker and coloring it on that knot, not the leader itself, just the knot. And he's not getting bit off as much.
And I could see that. You know, I could definitely see that, because if you look at your line-to-line knot coming through the water, whether it's fluorocarbon or not, you've built it up and bunched it up where, you know, look at those little fry that are out there. The most predominant thing that you see is the head, because the rest of the body's very, very much transparent, but the head is only semi-transparent, which would simulate you're not coming through the water.
No,
so I could see that happening, and painting it black might help significantly.
RJ?
Well, I know that when light goes through monofilament underwater, if you got a bunch of monofilament in a bunch, it almost looks like a light show. We used to go on those trips where we'd go down into Lighthouse Hole and places like that to recover the big balls of monofilament and other garbage that was down there. And they actually look pretty cool when the light hits them. So I'm thinking that knot probably makes something that the light bends through and makes it much more visible than just a straight piece of monofilament.
So like Robert's idea that it looks like the head of a anchovy or glass minnow, and that would make the fish want to eat that. Because as you're saying, that knot bunches it up, makes it a bigger presence. The light hits it, reflects, and now you got the head of a minnow. I never thought about it that way.
So that makes perfectly good sense. If you paint it black, they won't see it.
It stops the light refraction off of it.
Right, and I think that's what the mackerel are looking for, is anything that glints, you know, makes a little flash of something.
I like that.
And that knot is probably a pretty good at making that happen. You know, because you got this fiber optic thing going down where the whole monofilament line is gathering light, but it's coming out in the bends.
Little prism effect.
Little prism effect, right. Yeah, so.
Okay. Well, now,
that's
see,
a good theory. I like it a lot.
When you come into Fish and Frank's, our store, this is, people say, well, how did you figure that out? Well, we work in a tackle store, and we talk to people all day long. Average is about 200 people a day come through the store. Some days a lot more, some days less, but the average is around 200. When you're speaking to all these people, and they're all asking you, what do I do here, what do I do there, how do I do this, how do I do that? And then we can get around with like three of us, and we sit and talk about it like this, and next thing you know, bada bing, I think we got an answer again.
Yeah, Absolutely. I mean, that happens quite often where it's just bouncing it off of everybody else and getting different perspectives from our own personal experiences and then going, okay, well, that's the same thing I experienced and that makes a lot of sense and
so,
rolling with it.
Anyway, boys and girls, we cannot tell you scientific truth, but we can tell you in our opinion, we all kind of agree that the knot, when you come off your braiding line, you're tying that heavy knot, whether it's monofilament or fluorocarbon, it's kind of making an extra glow, kind of making it like the head of a small bait fish, where the other fish are likely to hit that, hereby you're losing your fish, you're losing your rig. So anyway, moving on, Robert right now has said Spanish mackerel's the number one easy catch in the harbor, number one easy thing. And that's been centraled around Boca Grande Pass area, a little bit up in the harbor, but very scattered throughout the holes up to marker two. But most of the concentrations are from the Bull Bay out through Boca Grande Pass and into that area around there, out a few markers into the Gulf. Kind of an unusual thing for this time of year. I'm almost, and I mean almost, thinking black drum. It has become, black drum's kind of gone from a few guys, oh, I caught a big drum, you know, no big deal, to, wow, I got a big drum. And it is gaining game fish royalty quickly. And when snook, trout, and redfish were taken off of the table, literally, you can't put them on your table right now. You're not allowed to keep them.
Right.
They were, people started looking for another cool fish to catch. And this is a monster that can be caught on pretty light tackle that can, if you're patient with it, I've caught 40-pound black drum on 10 and 12-pound monofilament. Now, I've also had, we used to anchor up at the 41 bridge. Now, when you come up on the harbor side of the bridge and you look at the center span, if you go to the south towards Punta Gorda, you idle along in front of there, and you're going to see something that looks like a swastika with loops on the end of it. It's not, you know, just the square, which originally was a good fortune mark and then went to the, you know, dreaded Nazi symbol. But this has loops on the end, and that marks a deep hole there. And that hole still exists there, and it's scratched into the pilings on the bridge so that you can tell where that hole is. If you anchor up there, put a big crab on. Now, you want to be a decent cast away from the bridge, and you're on the harbor side. So this has to be done during an incoming tide. This is not an outgoing tide thing. Incoming tide, anchor out, and what you really want to do is drive your boat under the bridge next to that piling so you can look on your depth finder and see where that hole stops and drop your anchor out at the end of that hole so you're not, your anchor is not in the hole, it's outside of it, and you're casting back at the bridge. Now, I've been there with 50 pound test mono and 60 pound leader, 6 ounce sinker to hold it in place. Because I just want it on the bottom, but I want it to stay really close to the marker. So you got to be very careful where you cast. And we want to drop that right by those pilings. And you get it there, and I would say the normal thing is to go away from the rod, set it in the rod holder, have a drink, and, you know, relax, and you're chit-chatting, and then the rod goes off. The problem with that is you're right on the piling.
Right.
You're right there. I mean, that fish goes more than a couple of feet. He's probably going around the back of the piling. So you really want to have that rod either be very close to it where you can pick it up and get it going. Because if you've got it locked down in the rod holder and that fish gets on there and really starts pulling, you're not getting it out of the rod holder.
Right.
It's going to be all bent. You're not going to be able to get it up without breaking the rod. So you got to have a little bit of a loose drag or just a clicker on. And then once that fish gets there, what I do is I grab the spool and just, if I got a circle hook on, I just want to lean back into it. I want to tighten the line up, reeling a little bit, hold it with my hand or put my thumbs on a conventional and walk back till I kind of feel it tight, then just walk a couple more steps just to pull that hook in good. Because you can't pull the hook back and set it, but I can walk it back and kind of
applying even pressure,
steady even pressure to where that hook's going to set. If you got a circle hook, instead if you try and set the hook, it'll jerk it right out of his mouth. So what I want to do is just nice steadier pressure, and then all of a sudden I'm just whoom, coming back with that rod, not just a nice good hard steady pull, and that will
more than likely hook them,
more than likely get them. But then I got to readjust my drag, and so what I end up doing is having to hold the spool, let go of the spool, reel, grab the spool, pull up, reel to going down, pull up, because I don't have time right then to readjust that whole drag on a spinning reel.
No.
So I'm literally grabbing the spool, pulling the rod back towards me, and when I let go of the spool so that I can, you know, get the bail to, or the rotor to go around and put line on, now I'm reeling as I lower that rod tip, extending it out, grabbing the spool again to pull them back. Because otherwise, if I take the time to readjust everything and get everything where I want it, I'm going to lose the fish.
No, that's true. And there, you know, and because you're fishing for those black drum around those pilings and structure, it's so easy for them to get up next to one of those pilings and snap you off super easy.
Well, I think the hook and everything is kind of annoying for them.
Well, you think?
I don't think they get like, oh my God, I'm upset. I think, oh man, that feels weird. And they go to rub their face or their, you know, it's like they get an itch. They're going to rub it on the piling.
Yeah, I could see that.
Like, oh, I got something stuck in here. Well, if you don't have hands and fingers, arms, they can't reach up with a fin and try and pull something out from their mouth.
Right.
So if you think of it in terms, your arms are tied to your side. You can't use your hands. So your arms and your hands, if you had something bothering you by your side of your jaw, you would go up to the edge of a table and try and rub your face on it to get that out, right?
Yeah, I'd go with that.
I mean, it just seems to be, rubbing around on it, trying to get that thing to come out. And I think that's what they do. That's why they break you off so easy.
And yeah, I can see that, absolutely.
If you can get them away from that where they're just going to kind of swim, next thing you know, here you go, you're landing this big fish. But if you get to the point, you're going to pull real hard on that rod, jerk them back, and try and drag them up to you, that fish is gone. He's 40 to 60 pounds. If he turns his head quick and just does a big shake, pow, out of here.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because I watched a girlfriend obviously fish a lot, and she's been catching quite a few of those black drum, and we live next to a bridge, so it's all about trying to keep those fish from getting up next to those pilings. You got to have your bait close to it because that's where they're hanging at, because they primarily feed on crustaceans, so they'll actually move up and down the pilings like you're used to seeing a sheep's head do, and they're in there trying to pull off bigger crabs. Sometimes they'll even actually suck off some of those oysters that will grow on the seawalls or those pilings.
Well, I'm glad the girls weren't here for that one.
Yeah.
So
they'll crush that up, and then, you know, so if your bait's really close to those pilings, that's your best chance to get them, but it's also your number one way to lose them. So it's a finesse thing, and one trick that I watched her do, and I don't think she realized she was doing it intentionally, but it was an old snook trick that I think either you or maybe Norm explained to me. When those fish are running towards a piling, sometimes if you cup that spool and put really hard opposite pressure to the point of almost breaking them and get them to turn just a little bit, like they're going to turn away from that piling, and then go forward and put almost a little bit of slack in the line, it almost launches those fish forward away from that structure and allows you to catch up to them.
Well, what you have to do in that instance, they're fighting the fish, and he's heading towards the piling, and this is Hail Mary. This is it. You've got one shot to make this work. If you have a spinning reel, take one hand and cup the spool so the line cannot come off. Hold your rod at almost high noon. I mean, almost straight up. You want to be, let's say, 11:55 with your rod pointing up in the air. Not an 12 o'clock maybe, 12:05 you'll probably break the rod. So you want to be 11:50 to 12 o'clock, analog clock looking. And you've got that rod held there. You cup the spool. The fish cannot pull line. But now what you're using, and this is where having a nicer graphite taper rod comes in, because the lighter tip, that starts bending, then every inch down that rod bends, the pressure slowly increases to the fish. And as the rod gets over more and more and more and more and more, that's more and more and more and more pressure on the fish. So it's allowing the rod to do what it was designed for. And that's, every inch should be a little bit more pressure. If your rod has a big bow in the middle when you do it, and it doesn't take much to get there, it's not going to work like for this. Like an older ugly stick, they just kind of bent over to the middle and just kind of stopped there. But with these newer rods, like say a Star Stellar Light, the Penn Battalion, you hold that rod up there, and as it pulls over every little bit, and that gradually increasing force is what will turn an object.
Right.
You know,
in most instances.
Well, if you walk up to, it's a lot easier. When I worked on the farms, if you're trying to get a big cow or a steer or a pig to go to the right, you would just kind of ease them along a little bit, kind of in a big curve, and they would end up there. If you tried to make them do a hard right turn, they were out of there.
Yeah.
They were going backwards, left. They were going to go everywhere but
fight
right.
Fight you as hard as possible. Yeah.
But if you just kind of nudged them a little bit and you worked them in an arc, they would go that way. Mm-hmm. They didn't really, because you weren't forcing them that way. You're kind of, you know, easing them that way.
Right.
And it's the same thing with a fish. But that's what that rod was designed to do. The newer graphite, you know, where you've got a light action tip. And what you want to do is, you know, hold on to the rod. Have somebody take the tip and pull down on it and away from you a little bit while holding that rod up about to, when you go to practice, it's about 10, 10:30, not 11. And because they need to pull towards them away from you while they're pulling down. 99% of the people break their rod trying to do this test because the person on the tip of the rod pushes it towards the person fish holding the rod, curls the rod up, blows it apart. Boom, rod's busted to pieces. But if they hold the rod tip and pull it towards themselves away from the person holding the rod, that rod will take tremendous amounts of pressure. But as soon as it goes back towards the person holding it, that U-shape blows it right apart. How are the snook doing on the beaches?
I would say it's been about average. It depends on which beach you go to. Like they did a beach renourishment out there, Boca Grande, from the old broken down pier all the way up to the middle lighthouse, basically First Street.
Do we know the story of that pier, what that actually was, or how that went?
I forget, because it was built back in the late 70s, early 80s, when that old road used to actually go around South Beach there, when you could actually drive.
I think
drive
it took
that.
Like one storm to knock it apart.
Yes, that's what I remember hearing, too. I forget which the hurricane was that took it out.
But I'll have to find out. I'm kind of curious about that now, because I've never really gave it much thought.
I mean, I don't even think it was up a year.
No, was the dock on it even finished, or did they just get the pilings and suffered that much structural damage from
it? No, I think they lost the surface of it because okay. Those parts were being picked up all over the place. You know.
Yeah, from what I remember, they kind of put it in, and it was like, it's like they're doing the beach renourishment right before hurricane season.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I find that amazing.
That's brilliant.
I mean, what kind of nincompoop does this kind of stuff? You do that in October, November. That way, all the money you spent, our winter friends, they
get about
down.
9 months out of it instead of two.
And
if you're lucky.
That beach renourishment only has a 50-50 shot of being there by October. One storm comes up the Gulf. That stuff's out of here.
Right, and that stuff's not compacted yet from being on the beach. It's still pretty fluffy. It doesn't take much for the
one
water
storm.
To move. Doesn't take much for the water to move all that out of there and send it right back to where it came from.
It can be gone in less than a day.
That's right.
And plus extra. So this is something you do in October, November, and you get out there and you put all the new beach in. People can enjoy it all season. You stand some chance of getting your money out of it.
Yeah.
But right now, whoever did that and decided this was the time you're going to do this, they need to have a different job, because they should not be doing that job. That is inexcusable, terrible waste of taxpayers' money.
You know, we should be running the world, the three of us, but unfortunately that's not the case.
Well, I don't have to run the world. I just ask people not to do really stupid stuff.
You're right.
I mean, oh, you got a better price on it now? What, you saved $100 and nobody might not anybody ever see it.
But Frank, we see that through the whole Suncoast.
Oh, what I love
is... They re-nourish beaches in the fall. Is it because they want to get them nice and ready for the tourists to come down and walk on them? Well, like you say, one storm and we're right back to gravel again.
Yeah, but I drive down Harbor Boulevard one day, and I'm looking, and they're putting in new pipes all the way, or new sidewalks. They put in all these new sidewalks, and then they got and it looks really nice, nice job, and they're putting the sod down, looks really good. It was actually a very nice job. But, and sidewalks are kind of cool. But as they're putting the sod down, a guy's coming throwing pipe down on the brand new sod. I mean, he's literally having to wait for them to put the sod down so he can put the pipes down so they can rip all the sod back up to put the pipes in. Really? Nobody actually calls and goes, hey, you got pipe to do? Well, I'm doing a sidewalk. Okay, tell you what, let me get 100 feet ahead of you. You come right behind me putting a pipe in. What would be so hard about that?
Jeez, I don't know.
I mean, if I ran my store that way, I would be out of business. And let's face it, I'm not the best business person ever hit the planet. And if you're worse than me, you might want to rethink. You're in the wrong job, you know? But they wouldn't know they were in the wrong job. Anybody that dumb would never have a clue that they're doing it wrong. I mean, God. I can't stand that. All right.
So the snook on the beaches
we talked about.
No, we didn't.
Okay, what did we talk about?
We got squirreled on that one. The closer you get to the passes is where the better numbers are, especially out by Boca Grande, because of that beach renourishment. That beach renourishment brings in a lot of sand, but it brings in infertile sand, so they cover up the coquinas, the sand fleas, and all the critters that all the prey items would be normally
now,
feeding on.
Do they mostly die, or they just go
they
down?
No, nah, it smothers them. It buries them. They raise 10 feet of sand right there at the restaurant. It's up to the top of the old road.
And it takes, I would say, a couple years to get all that stuff, that life back up to better amounts.
Yeah. So there's no real food source right there in that immediate area. So as you get closer to the passes, that's where you're finding a lot of your little finger whiting, a lot of little glass minnows and greenbacks and stuff like that. It seems like there's a lot of life right by the pass. Plus, the passes are starting to flood a little bit more with the tannin water because the rivers are starting to flow. So there's some nutrients in that attract those bait fish and micro and macro algaes in there. So those snook have been feeding real heavy. So anywhere
now,
you get within 100 yards of those passes is your better bet for...
Do you think that's the reason we haven't had as many sand fleas over the last few years?
Absolutely. I think it plays a great role in it. I mean, when was the last time you ask anybody to go to the beach where they've done beach renourishment in the last, say, 3 years and just take a sand sifter or a sand flea rake and scoop into that sand... See how hard it is, how long it takes you to find just a couple of sand fleas, let alone maybe one. But also look at the coquinas, which are those little tiny mollusks / clams that dig down in the sand. They're real pretty. They're rainbow colored and stuff like that. And
oh, yeah, the little tiny jobs that go through there. And they're quick.
Yeah, the wave washes over the sand. It moves that way, and you'll see these shells, and all of a sudden you see these shells digging down really quick back underneath the sand. That's a coquina.
How does something without feet... and without arms, toes, fingers, move that fast?
A tongue. A really good tongue.
Really?
if you want I'm going to try to get you to
we're
move on
that
from
one
that one. Yeah.
We're going to the next one.
if you take a walk on Casperson Beach, which as far as I know has not ever been renourished.
The beach of the big tongues?
Yeah. The beach
okay.
The, It's a beach that's teeming with life. Yes. Ghost crabs, coquinas, right up to every kind of shorebird you can think of. And then you go to the Renourish beaches, and
just
there's nothing.
Just a quarter mile up by Sharkies.
Yeah.
Just go a quarter mile north to Sharkies, and you'll see where there's virtually nothing there.
Yeah. And so you'll go to these beaches, and you won't see the shorebirds. You won't see the sandpipers, because there's nothing for them to eat.
Well, even looking in the water, you won't see the baitfish around. You won't see those little finger whitings or those little schools of greenbacks or glass minnows that like to cruise along that surf line. It's almost basically void of life. You know, it's pretty sad and frustrating all at the same time. And like you said, just to watch it get washed away later anyhow. But, you know, after a year or two, sometimes three, you start to see that life come back, you know, but it's never as intense as it was.
Well, it would take 5-10 years of stable beach to get back to that point.
Yeah, exactly.
So, which is really isn't that much. I mean, in 3 to 5 years, that could be just loaded with life. But in years ago, the wife figured out why the beaches are eroding away. It's pretty simple. There used to be a layer of oysters. When I first came to the beaches in Florida, the very first time I ever saw them, you had to walk across 15, 20 feet of big broken oyster shells.
Oysters and clams and scallops.
Yeah, I mean, and some of these things were 4 inches wide and 6-8 inches long, and they were just scattered pieces of them and whole ones. But there was a band, so you had from the water up where the waves would run on their kind of normal wave pattern, and so you had about 15, 20 feet from the water up to that. And then there was about 10 to 20 feet of these big scattered shells. And then there was nice sand all the way up to wherever you parked or, you know, the top of the beach. But without that buffer for the waves to hit on, when the storms came, it hit and the force of the wave was deflected by those big pieces. And it acted like a protective shield. So it didn't just hit there and drag the sand back with it. It hit those shells. The force of the wave was dissipated. The water ran back in the ocean. The sand stayed place. And the more those big shells that were piled up there, that's why the beaches grew bigger over time, not smaller. Because it was always adding those big shells up to it, which deflected the force of the wave and allowed the sand to build up behind it. Mm-hmm. And once all those were gone, and I'm guilty, I took some in a bucket, put them home in a thing on the wall, and people used them in their gardens, and it was just, oh, there's just shells on the beach. No one knew it was the protective layer for the beach.
Right. No, and I agree with that. I mean, to help reduce that erosion, it works significantly with that. I mean, we see it in islands that have some mangroves around them, and you'll see where it's stepped up from oysters to barnacles to little rocks to the mangroves, and you'll see those protected little shorelines that can absorb all that pressure from waves, that it makes it much healthier overall looking.
And it just, the sand can actually build up there and not be ripped off, which I think we could do simply by making some foam fake oyster shells, scattering them along the beaches. You know, they could be made out of some kind of clay or something like that, and just go along, scatter them.
Concrete sandbags and just place them in random places along the thing.
The concrete sandbags won't work because that's one spot and then the water washes around it.
Oh, yeah.
It's got to be a whole bunch of little, almost like interlaced little shells to catch the force of the wave and let it drain off. If you were to put big objects there, they would just sink because the sand would wash around them and they would just go down in lower and lower and lower.
Right.
But a bunch of little tiny, like, I don't know, coffee saucer, you know, cup-sized saucer things, just scattered all through there, you know, overlapping each other and just piled up, you know. And if it was made out of even a biodegradable rubber or plastic, you know, and you could just keep scattering them along the beach there, you would literally just build the beaches up. It would take years, but you wouldn't lose any more beach.
Yeah, I could see that. That'd be a fun experiment.
But they won't let you do it.
No, they won't let you do it.
Because I, you know, the only reason I can't get this tried is I don't have a picture from that time and those where that shell belt was. They want a physical picture of it. Otherwise, they said, yeah, if you can get us a picture to show us that shell layer was there, we can, you know, we'll allow you to test this theory. Because that would be replacing an something that was there. But because I never could find a picture of it, I could never get the permit. All I'm missing is a picture.
Well, I just wish that they wouldn't renourish the beaches the way, and I think that's the wrong word for it, but that's what they call it. I wish they just wouldn't do it. And if they were going to do it, it should be much, much bigger spans of time in between when they do that.
I think what they need to do is do way more than they're doing now. And if you're going to do this, because it's harmful, it doesn't matter if it's harmful a bit or a lot of bit, say, okay, we want 100 feet of beach? No. Add 300 or 400 feet of beach so that it takes longer to wear back down onto it. You know what I mean? It is a possibility of being there for 5 years or 6 years, not just one season, and then have to do it again, you know.
Yeah. No, and I agree with that, you know, and just... You get 200 feet of beach, but if it's only 100 feet of beach, we're bringing it out to 400. When it gets down to 200, we're bringing in another 200 feet of beach.
But if you know, you maintained it and only added a bit of sand each time, bring it way out, and as soon as it gets in a little bit, add a bit to it, but not 10 feet deep and 200 feet wide.
Right.
Because then some of the bottom shells and stuff could actually stay there. So you could actually leave like a trough there and put a new layer out in front of it.
Yeah.
With just, you know, say a foot, then you have to come up like a sand dune to get to the rest of the beach.
But then they'd have to walk really far to get to the water from the parking lot.
Well, I thought rich people were into hiking and biking and, you know, I thought that's what rich people did, jog and stuff. Isn't that the Pilates stuff or whatever
it is
they do?
Yeah, health nut stuff, yeah.
I thought that's what rich people did was, you know, healthy things. So they're too lazy to walk out on the beach? Okay.
Yeah, I always thought Pilates was some kind of meat pie.
All right. Permit and cobia.
Yeah, that one's been kind of interesting. I mean, the weather's been a little wonky, but it straightened out a little bit this past week, so the guys that have been fishing near shore, 5 to, say, up to even 20 miles out, have been seeing permit scattered on a lot of the man-made reefs, and quite a few cobia starting to show up also out there as bycatch. You know, they're anchored up or drifting and just having 1 to 3 cobia swim up to the boat. Couple guys that have been fighting some of the nurse sharks that they've been catching as bycatch bottom fishing, or some of the guys who are targeting the Goliath grouper / jewfish out there, as they're bringing them up, it's bringing up a small group of cobia with them. You know, so it's been really good for that. And with this new moon that we've got going on, there's actually been somewhat of a crab flush going on. You know, the river has raised up. You know, when you and I looked at it last week, it was 9.5 feet, I think it was.
It's a little less than that right now, but this rain hopefully maybe bring it up a little bit. But
it'd come up from 7 to like 9 feet. So we're seeing that good enough flush where between the moon and the river rising last week, we've been seeing some very large blue crabs being pushed out of the river and heading towards the passes. People are seeing the iridescent swimming crabs, or the pass crabs, most people call them, anywhere from on the surface to even down to seeing them as deep as 15 feet under the water out there. Even some guys are seeing them out there as far as 30 miles swimming on the surface in the middle of the day. So there has been a little bit of a crab flush. I think that's what's getting these permit and these cobia excited. The drawback is that getting blue crabs in general for bait shops has been a little tricky because
we actually did good this week. We had a lot of crabs this week.
This week, but we went 2 weeks before that, but that was also part of the crab closure for July 1st for those 10 days or two weeks when they got to remove all their traps out of the water for 10 days or 14 days so they can find any derelict or abandoned or lost crab traps and remove them from the waterways. So that's made it a little tricky, but hopefully we'll start to get on back on track with getting crabs for the bait, because that's, you know, the weird part is all these manufacturers have made hundreds and hundreds of fake fish and eels and snakes and everything else for lures. I don't know of one single crab lure that
Weston.
That's the one that I was thinking of that might be a good possibility, because that's new, so I haven't
tried
it yet.
I think Weston, they've been catching redfish with them.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't tested on permit yet, but I think it's the only crab in all of them I've seen. Everybody always, oh, buy this crab lure, it's so realistic. Yeah, it is. It's very real, except the reality is it don't catch fish.
Right.
But the Weston, I'm going to go with the Weston as
like
the best shot
it.
Of catching permit. You name it. If it's out in the Gulf and wants a little crab to eat, I'm going to the Weston.
I want to try that and experiment.
I bought literally $1,000 worth of Westons just so I could have that run of crabs there.
Yeah.
It's a gorgeous line of crab lures.
Yeah, it'll be impressive to see.
And
because
they've actually been catching redfish with it.
Yeah, I've heard of a few guys catching redfish with them. You know, but I'd like to go out there and, you know, number one, catch a nice big permit, because I've never done it. I've never landed a big one, so I'd like to go out there and try that Weston on it and see how it does, because no
I
other
think
crab.
A Weston with a little tiny bit of Procure rock it out. I think it would rock it on.
Going to give it a shot.
All right, and let's see, tarpon, still a lot of tarpon, a lot of people coming down to do tarpon fishing. In fact, I think there's more, I've had more tourists in coming down to do tarpon fishing this month in the last couple of weeks than we had in June, which is really weird. In June,
yeah.
We had almost no tourists. We had a lot of people tarpon fishing,
right.
But not a lot of tourists. It seemed to be a combination of snowbirds and locals, but in the last week or two, we've had a ton of tourists from out of town, people that have come down and want to catch tarpon, and I think it's about 50-50 between the ones they're seeing in the shallow water or the canals and the ones out in the harbor. Now, are the deep holes in the harbor doing well? If so, what do you use out there? And what about the Mica River?
You kind of covered them all, because the fish are, they've been really broken up. On Sunday, they were really piled in real heavy between the top of the 20-foot hole all the way up to marker 2. To Ponce de Leon, to the mouth of the Mica, just that big, probably I'm gonna say it was about 5 square miles roughly area.
Okay.
They were really, really heavy in there with a lot of bait fish around. And then on Monday, they broke apart and were just 2 here, 6 here, 5 here, 3 here, all over from marker 2 all the way down to Boca Grande Pass. So I think it just kind of varies a little bit depending on the day that you get out there to see them. And there's a lot of 30 pounders in one little batch, 80 pounders in another batch, and 120 pounders in another batch. They're semi-segregated a little bit, but they are in the same general area with each other. And the main focus of lure is a bait buster. That's just crushing it right now, and live thread fins if you can get them.
But now, if you're going to go back on the flats, and I'm talking about off Grassy Point, on the sandbar on the east side of the harbor, the west side, on the flats from Hog Island out to the Mica River,
mm-hmm.
where you have that, you know, something where you've got less than 6 feet of water.
Right.
That Rapala, I don't know if it's a subwalk or I don't know what they call it, but it's got 2 single hooks on it. And you work it like an underwater Zara spook, where you're walking the dog.
I think it's the subwalk.
It could be. I don't remember. But it's not a tarpon lure.
No.
But the tarpon decided it was a tarpon lure.
Yeah.
You know, you're going out and you're just fishing for whatever, and you catch a tarpon. Now you're okay. Well, that was cool. Nice accidental catch. And then you go along and you're fishing for whatever, and you get another tarpon. Well, this is a lure the tarpon decided was a good tarpon lure.
Yeah.
And they're the best judge. Excuse me. They're the best judge of what's the right lure to use.
Well, what gives them the right? I'm fishing, Frank. I should be able to decide what's a good tarpon lure.
That's right. You should.
You know, I should be able to make these decisions.
Right.
Nope. Can't.
Nope. And it was by coincidence, you know, it was by complete accident, because guys were using them for snook and redfish, and even trout were eating them.
It was okay. I will say, we didn't get great numbers of snook or trout or redfish or anything else on them. It was doing good, but I don't know if it was out long enough. But if there's tarpon in the area, they're going to get to it before the other species are.
Yeah. Yeah, it used to be where it was just an accidental bycatch once in a while with any lure along those semi-shallow waters. But if there's a tarpon in the area, it seems to be wanting to crush that lure.
So yeah, it's just kind of a weird one. I don't know what the heck was going on with that. But hey,
just a pleasant surprise, especially when you can fool a tarpon into some new lure.
RJ just looks, he goes, you know, you got 1 minute to the left to explain why tarpon shouldn't be able to pick their own lure.
That's right.
Okay. I'm not sure why. I guess we'll let them pick their what they want to eat. You know,
just let us know, though.
Yeah. Yeah, if they would let us know. But that was a good thing. They did let us know.
Yep.
I was kind of surprised. It's not a lure I would have picked for tarpon on the flats. But
No, not at all.
Sometimes the ones that aren't supposed to do the job actually do the job. Look at me. I shouldn't have been doing this job, but I've been doing it for 34 years. So.
And a fine job at that.
Yeah, right. Okay. Fine job, I'd be rich. All right, Fish and Frank here. Robert, the chair across from me. Commander RJ in Control Center. Thank you, guys. We'll catch you next week. Fish, fish, fish. Boy, I'm going fishing just to eat.